ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
Mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration, and energy.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming up.
On ABC Radio.
I said to Mr. Whitlam, would you mind coming outside with this, you know, with the blue sky in the background, and it was a lovely day, and we repeat that handover. And he said, very well. We go out, and I put a cross on the ground in the dirt. You stand there. And then I led dear old Uncle Vincent out because his eyesight, you know, the trachoma, and I led him, sort of led him out and said, Uncle, I want to take a photo outside. And he said, okay, boy, okay, boy. And so set them up, and people were thinking, well, what's going on here?
The image is iconic. Under a fierce blue sky, then Prime Minister Gough Whitlam pours a fistful of earth into the weathered hand of Gurindji elder Vincent Lingiari. It's a moment that has endured for 50 years, not just because of the piece of history it captured, but because of what it dared to say, that this stolen land, fought for and symbolically returned, remembers, and so must we. You probably know all about the story of both the moment and the photograph that immortalised it, but do you know the story of the photojournalist who took it? Welcome to Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. Mervyn Bishop turned 80 earlier this year, and after countless exhibitions and a lifetime of using his photographic skills to help people see the world a little more clearly, Merv himself is the focus of an illustrated biography called Black, White and Colour. It's been written by Merv's longtime friend and former journalist, Tim Dobbin.
Personally, when you get to know him more, it's his gregarious nature. He finds photography satisfying in a sort of social way. He's, you know, very generous, very funny, but, you know, he can be the cranky uncle. I think what makes Mervyn's photography sing is his empathy for people. And it doesn't matter their social status, their race. He described for me his philosophy around portraiture, which is probably his strongest point. And he said he wants to produce something that both the subject and the viewer can look at and think, yes, you captured something there. I got the essence of the person. The book came about because after I'd retired from Reuters and Daily Journalism, I felt I wanted to do a book. And I knew there was none better subject than Mervyn Bishop, someone I'd known nearly my whole life, but yet didn't really know his full story. And I wanted to tell the remarkable story of this man while placing his life in the context of post-1945 Australia. He was born in 1945. And in the context of the broader struggles of first Australians to gain rights they'd been denied since European settlement.
The release of Black, White and Colour coincides with an exhibition that'll open at the State Library of New South Wales later this month, and the combination of both the book and the exhibition provides a rare look at a visual storyteller whose lens has captured the beating heart of Australian history and Indigenous identity. Mervyn Bishop, welcome to Speaking Out.
Good morning, Larissa.
Congratulations on the book. It's beautiful.
Have you seen it already?
I have. I've seen it in the PDF version. I can't wait to see it in a hard copy, but of course your photographs make it lovely and the text looks beautiful. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's quite a task over that 3 years.
Well, it's quite a lifetime too that you encapsulate in it. But I thought maybe we could start by getting you to tell us a little bit about where you grew up and who the biggest influences were on you.
Oh, right. Now, I was born in a little town out west called Brewarrina, about 200 miles from Dubbo, in 1945. grew up there, went to school there. Dad was a shearer's cook. My mum did home duties and little pieces of work when she could. My sister Cynthia and I are the only children. My sister Cynthia lives here in Dubbo now. She just celebrated her 77th birthday. And I've got two children. My son Timothy, he lives in Sydney. He's 49. And my daughter Rosemary lives here in Dubbo. She's 40. They both have two children each, girl and a boy each. And so proud, and it's lovely to have family about.
Can you tell us about your early life and what led you to photography?
Early life, Brewarrina. I was going to Brewarrina Central School, and my dear mum had a box camera, and she'd take pictures of us, just family images. And every now and then we'd have photographs taken by a visiting studio, and we'd always get family photographs done. In those days they were black and white and hand-coloured images. Very lovely. Still got them, some of them. And then as I was growing up, I had an interest in photography, I used to borrow mum's box brownie camera and go and take a few pictures with it, much to her sometimes horror. But I've still got some of those images. So that's back in 1954, 55. At that time, there was a big flood in Brewarrina, and there was about a half a mile away from where we lived was the old aerodrome, and all these aircraft used to come in to refuel and take supplies and bits and pieces out to isolated stations. And a friend of mine, Robert Waugh, we'd ride our bikes out there, and we sort of knew all the aircraft and who was the pilots. We were sort of, I suppose, what would you call us? Just two kids loving aeroplanes. So I borrowed my mum's camera one day, took some pictures, and she said, "Well, you know, why do you take pictures of aeroplanes?" And at that time I said, "Well, Mum," I said, "I love aeroplanes. When I grow up, I want to be a pilot." And anyway, school went on. And there was a Bush brother, or a couple of Bush brothers, Anglican Bush brothers were at Dubbo, came from Dubbo, Brotherhood of the Good Shepherd. They would have Bush brothers from all parts of Australia and overseas. And one of the chaps, Brother Richard, he was a kind of keen photographer, and he came from England. And he'd be taking pictures here and there in his little Zeiss Icon. And then he decided to buy a 35mm camera and to take colour slides, so that when he went back to England, he could show his family and friends back there. Brother Richard, his name's John Richard Henry Palmer, and had the name of Richard. They gave him the name of Brother Richard. And so Brother Richard is still alive. He lives in Cornwall, right down at the Lizard. And I speak with him every now and then through his wife, Veronica, their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. And I missed out on taking a trip over there to see him. So he's in his 90s now. So we've always had this keen interest in photography.
It's obviously a big step to love photography as a young person and to be engaged with it, and then to actually choose it as a career. I wonder if you could share with us how it was you came to work as the first Aboriginal Australian press photographer, really a photojournalist, and what was that like in the 1960s and 70s when you were, you know, pretty much trailblazing through that in terms of being the first Aboriginal person in that space?
Going to school in Brewarren, I'd saved my money and would cash in drink bottles, and I bought a 35mm camera. This is about 1956 for £15. And when Mum saw it, she said, "What a funny little camera! It doesn't, you know, it's only small image." I said, "Well, we need a projector so we can have slide nights." And so I used to borrow a slide projector, and we'd have some images. We'd have a bit of a slide night inside, and then we went to putting up a sheet on the clothesline and projecting the images there. And half the street would come along and have a look, and I was really chuffed by it all, and Mum and Dad were too, and Sister Cynthia. So from there, a chap by the name of Vic King. He was a tractor grader driver for Brewarren Council, and he had a little darkroom at his house, and I went around there and kind of dabbled in the darkroom. And when we did the first print, seeing an image come up in the developer, I was hooked on black and white photography.
And how did you come to start at the Sydney Morning Herald?
Well, I went to Dubbo High School, my steam train from Brewarren, boarded a Church of England boys hostel, and went to Dubbo High School, and had my camera with me, but didn't take many pictures, so I did some. And the folks in Sydney knew that I was keen on photography. Mr. Alan Dobbin, who was a sub-editor on the Sydney Morning Herald, he knew that I was really very interested in photography rather than doing menial sort of tasks in Sydney. My first job when I went to Sydney, I was working at the ABC in William Street. And it was a copy boy type person. And so I thought, well, look, who knows where this is going to lead. Anyway, there was an interview arranged for me at the Sydney Morning Herald to be a cadet photographer. I met with press photographer who was managing then, called Fred Halmarick, and we talked about my love for photography, and he said, "Well, have you got anything to show me?" And I said, "All I've got is a packet of Kodachrome slides." And we laid them out over a light box. And he said, "Wow, they're okay. They're nice." And he said, "You've been in a dark room?" I said, "Yes, in Brewarren, little, you know, bits and pieces." And he said, "Come on in, let's go in the dark room." And then I was kind of in a sort of a heaven, if you could call it that. There's all these enlargers and sinks and red lights, white lights, and so he said, "Want to do a print." So he set up an enlarger with a negative in it, and he said, "Well, have a go." So I did. I focused up and made an exposure with a foot pedal, and put it in the developer, and watched a well-exposed print come up in the developer, transferred to the fixer, and he said, "Well, that's pretty good." And I said, can I keep that? And he said, sure can. Anyway, we'd left the building, and about 3 weeks later, they offered me a cadetship at Sydney Morning Herald. And that was for 4 years. And we then, getting the cadetship, you learned all the intricacies of press photography, because in those days they were using speed graphic cameras with using 5x4-inch negatives and quarter plate negatives. And it wasn't until about 3 or 4 years later that they changed over to Nikons and 35mm. And of course, the cadets, every now and then we'd get to use the speed graphic. You could, you know, take pictures and then process them and print them. And I really liked that. And then along came Sydney Tech, who started a photography course. A chap by the name of Harry Millen, he was our teacher. We'd go there for a couple of hours, about 4 hours a week, a bit of part-time tech, and went through that. And so then about third year, or about third year, went out with a camera, with a photographer, what they call bag carrying, and you sort of lump his gear around while he was taking pictures, and you get to know how they worked and how they took their pictures for the paper. And so I sort of took all that in as much as I could. And I was in a little dark room with one of the greatest photographer in Australia, a chap by the name of George Lipman. George recently passed on. He was 91. I thought he was the best photographer in Australia, and trying to model myself after him was something. I know I, you know, tried, but every now and then some of the images I'd taken, I thought I'd show it to George and he'd say, well, what about this, what about that? You'd sort of get that running commentary. Loved it. And so I'm going to pay tribute to him and some of the other photographers. And we got on. I was going down the track. I was out on my own taking pictures for the Herald Sun, and then Aboriginal Affairs came into being, and someone suggested that I might suit a position down there. So that position was created, and my wife and I, Elizabeth, moved to Canberra, and I was travelling around Australia taking pictures of Aboriginal Affairs, which they wanted pictures like Aboriginal health, housing, sport, education, the cross-section of Aboriginal Affairs around Australia.
That's photographer Merv Bishop. I'll bring you more of my talk with Uncle Merv in a moment, but first, this is Miss Canina with her cover of the Charlie Pride classic, Crystal Chandeliers.
Marble statuettes are standing still.
You're listening to Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt, and that's Miss Canina putting a new spin on an old classic, Crystal Chandeliers. It was recorded live for ABC TV during NAIDOC Week earlier this year.
Speaking Out on ABC Radio.
We are here.
Indigenous culture, lifestyle and current affairs with Larissa Berendt.
Here on Speaking Out, I'm talking to Murray man and photographer Uncle Merv Bishop, who doesn't just take photographs, he listens through them to the land, the people, the moments. His career spanned photojournalism and art photography, where he documented major developments in Aboriginal communities, capturing images that imbued a sense of optimism for the future. Uncle Merv, I might just take you back to just before you take up that job with the Department of Aboriginal Affairs in 1974, because, of course, in 1971, you were awarded the Australian Press Photographer of the Year for a photograph called Life and Death Dash. And I just wonder if you could share with us your reflections and what we should know about that really iconic photograph. And I did, of course, want to acknowledge that in that time that you were working for the newspaper, you know, obviously your skill became very recognised because you did get that award. But tell us a bit about the Life and Death Dash photograph.
In those days, we'd have a car driver and a journalist photographer, and we'd be an early morning shift, and we were in the neighbourhood of Darlinghurst, and had a call about a policeman escorting a woman into St Margaret's Hospital in Darlinghurst, sick with sick children. So went up to see what was going on and got out of the car, and there was a head sister matron of the hospital, Sister Anne Byrne. She came out to help the mother, help take the children into hospital. She picked up the little boy, and she was a bit distraught, I guess, me being on the side, on the footpath, to take a picture. So I took this picture of her with him. I used it next day in the Sydney Morning Herald. It was got a startling photograph of Sister Anne with a hand up saying, "Go away," virtually. And then it was I edited it in press awards, and I won Australian News Photographer of the Year with it. I was going along and was on a certain grade, but I couldn't sort of, I suppose you'd say, I hit a glass ceiling, as they say. Couldn't sort of rise, you know, to get a better, better pay, better acknowledgement. So that's when Aboriginal Affairs came into being, and so I went down to, or we went to Canberra, where I took up the position of a kind of PR photographer there, DAA.
And as you say, I mean, obviously when you're doing the work for the newspapers, you're covering the news, so it wasn't necessarily taking photographs of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. You were, you know, covering the Whitefella news, and your photographs, including that very powerful one we just spoke about, the Life and Death Dash, were in that context. And as you say, you moved to Canberra, you're there in the Department of Aboriginal Affairs, and it's a very, you know, it's the time of Gough Whitlam. It's a very important era in Indigenous rights, and you're travelling around the country. Tell us about what that was like, and what were the things that really caught your attention and you remember of that time?
Well, I was quite surprised that Aboriginal Affairs hadn't progressed to, I suppose you could call it, helping Aboriginal folks around Australia. Some places, every different community place were different. Some were states of just existence, and others had makeshift housing, children hardly going to school. And out of that, there were cases of some bright children getting on and going to school and getting and progressing. And me being the only person doing that, it was quite a job. But I'd hoped that they might have had in each state a kind of a place where people could bring photographs in of projects that were done by the Aboriginal Affairs. And back in 1975, I was up in Brisbane. We had an exhibition there at the ECCA, and got a call from Canberra from one of the bosses to say that they wanted me and my film cameraman, Terry Horn, to go to Darwin and to a community for some pictures very soon. So we flew off to Darwin, and then on the way we met Keith Barlow and a journalist called Kay Keaveney from Women's Weekly, and he'd been up there for an aftermath of the cyclone, and he was going back to get pictures of it as it was then, 1975. Anyway, the next day we flew down to Wattie Creek for this ceremony and for me to take pictures of what was happening down there that day. The Prime Minister, then Gough Whitlam, was there, and We were taking pictures here, there, and everywhere, and then he, under the shade of a kind of a shed, I suppose that's what you'd call it, they had an obelisk with what was happening that day. He spoke dear old uncle Vincent Lingiari, who'd led the strike against Lord Vesti's pay rates and conditions for their living, and he sort of gave Uncle Vincent the deeds or scrolls, and then he poured the red soil into Uncle Vincent's hand, and it was a dull sort of a picture under the shed. So Keith and I said to Mr. Whitlam, when that had been finished, I said to Mr. Whitlam, would you mind coming outside with this, with the blue sky in the background, and it was a lovely day, and we repeat that handover. And he said, very well. We go out, and I put a cross on the ground in the dirt. You stand there. And then I led dear old Uncle Vincent out because his eyesight, the trachoma, and I led him out and said, Uncle, I want to take a photo outside. And he said, okay, boy. And so set them up, and people were thinking, well, what's going on here? And Keith Barlow's done to keep people away from this image, from this photo we were setting up. And so I had the first go at it, first crack at it, and I was using a Hasselblad with fill flash. Got about five images, and I said, "Well, okay, Keith, it's your turn." And he was shooting for Women's Weekly, so he kept people away from spoiling my image, and I had to keep people away from spoiling his image. And then after he was done, other folk were jostling in there to take their photographs. And that was kind of it. And that was the image, which that was taken on the 16th of August, 1975.
I was going to say, did you have any sense at the time that this was going to become such an iconic photograph? I mean, not only was it beautifully shot, now we understand why the lighting looks so lovely in it, but, it became such a symbol of that time, but also for reconciliation going forward. Did you have any sense of how historic the moment was at the time?
I had sort of a dream of it. I thought with the blue sky, you could go on the front page of a magazine poster with the Time Life or whoever, just thinking of the reproduction of it. And I said, I thought it was good. but Aboriginal Affairs didn't sort of push it too much. And I thought, what is the matter with them? So that was August. Then we go down to November, where outside Parliament House, Mr. Whitlam came forward and he was kind of deposed. And I thought, what? And so by the time I heard about it, I couldn't get there at that time when he came out and said, well, may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor General. And he was gone. Mr. Fraser then took over as Prime Minister. And he was quite a pleasant chap to deal with photography, because I think he's a very keen photographer.
It's such an important moment that you captured there with Gough Whitlam. But, of course, you were prolific in what you captured during that period. And you have become so known for the photograph of Vincent Lingiari and Gough Whitlam. But from your perspective of the other images that you've captured, what are some of the ones that mean the most to you personally that, you know, have kind of had a special place in your heart?
Wow. That's quite a quite a
it's a big question, a I know, Uncle Merv.
Quite a list. I mean, from that image, the song was kind of born out of it, you know, from little things, big things grow. And, you know, what that does now, or what is bandied about now. But at an exhibition called In Dreams at this Australian Centre for Photography, it was 30 years of my photographic works. And that was wonderful. And I was, you know, so, oh, I was so chuffed by it all. However, on that day, that evening, that afternoon, at the Centre for Photography, my dear wife, Elizabeth, was suffering from cancer, and she passed on that day.
Oh, how sad.
She'd given sort of instructions for whatever happened, I was to go to that exhibition, which was opened by dear Lois O'Donoghue. Now, in amongst all the photographs, I guess over the years, that one of the one of the favourite photographs is a photograph of my two cousins, Ralph and Jim Richardson. We went out to where our grandfather was working at a place called Gundawira outside of Brewarrina, and they saw a boat by the river, and they said, let's go for a row. So I jumped in with them, and I took a lovely picture of them rowing the boat, boys wagging school, and they thought it was wonderful. And so it's one of my favourites. There are other favourites. And and in this new biography that's being written and it's coming out now, it'll be in that, written by Tim Dobbin. And we conversed between, he was head of Reuters in Washington, D.C., and he's retired, and we conversed for 3 years, and now it's out. I've got an exhibition at the State Library on the 17th of this month, October. It's going to go for about 6 months, and as well as that, we'll have a release and sale through Glebe Books at Glebe for the book.
I did want to ask you about the book because, of course, it's called Black, White and Colour, and it is a wonderful reminder of how diverse your images are. And what I've always loved about your work, Uncle Merv, is that you obviously capture those big iconic moments and shots of history. And I love how when you take a picture of someone like Lionel Rose, we almost see him in a different way. You always capture something that no one else seems to have captured. And then, of course, you do these lovely photographs that are just a slice of life, an intimate encounter into somebody else's world. So the book is a wonderful account of your photographic practice and your life. And you did, as you say, work with biographer Tim Dobbin on the book. Can you tell us a little bit about, over those 3 years that you worked together, what was it like, and did you travel around together? How did you exchange your stories with him, and how did you work together to create such a wonderful collection of your life?
Tim had a pretty fair idea of my type of work. He came up to Dubbo, and we took a trip out west to Bourke, and then across to Brewarrina, hometown, had a few days there, seeing and meeting people who were still about. And then we took a trip up to Gadooga, from Brewarrina up to Gadooga, where my dad grew up, and met up with relations, some of my relations, and one in particular, a bloke called John Drought Bishop. His uncle, his name was John Drought Bishop, who was in the army during, he was in the occupation forces in Japan. And then we toured around a bit and Tim went back to America. And the next time he came out, he brought his dear wife, Sheila, I say Sheila, brought her out and had a bit of a sample of Dubbo and places and Canberra City, Melbourne City, and they'll be out here in a couple of weeks for the opening of the exhibition at the State Library, which will be just wonderful.
It's a wonderful celebration of everything you've achieved. I wonder if you could just, when you look back at the body of work you've done, and you talked a little bit about just even in the early years that you were delving into photography, how much the technology changed. And I wonder when you look back now, how have you seen photography change over time?
Wow, that's fantastic. It's fantastic. In the early days, you could take a picture on a speed graphic camera, process it 10 seconds, the print, the negative that is, and make a print within 20 seconds. We used to do that when we were covering the races on Saturdays to transmit the race finishes back to the Herald on via pictograms. And of course, that's a one-off thing. We had a photographic vehicle with a darkroom in it and transmitter. And we used to call that the pie truck because it looked like a big pie truck. And anyway, now these days it's gone into, oh, it's 35 mil, and that was quick enough, but it still had to process and print. Now it's digital, and chaps now using thousands and thousands of dollars of equipment. I can take pictures by the thousands, but I think the way of sorting it out, they're very good at sorting things, and so they to get the best images for and instantly pretty well to the papers and whoever they're working for. But I like sort of digital work, but when I lived in suburb Sydney called Oatley, had some renovations done and I built a darkroom. And I, my own little darkroom, and I used to get in there and paddle around with it, and it was just lovely to, you know, you could smell the chemicals and make prints, redo them. I still sort of want to do it. It's been my life and my love for, you know, 70 years. So I still think about it. And I'd like to say to people who got cameras, you don't have to have big super fancy cameras to be taking pictures. If you can take an image, you've recorded something, you've captured an image, and you can go from there, you can progress with equipment and with you know, your style. There's so much that you can see and look into. You might get in the old days, you'd get newspapers that really had very little images. And so I've got an agent who looks after my archive, and we get along very well. And so it's it's my images are going to be around for a long time. And they're going through to the state library for preservation. And so I'd say, well, I don't know if, Larissa, you take pictures, like most people have phones, and the phones take fantastic images. And, well, if there's something you want to take some pictures of it and save it and put it into a file, you know, a saving system. But it's capturing and recording the image.
I have to say, I've loved about this chat with you, Uncle Merv, is how you describe, as you're right, we can take pictures on our phone. We all have lots of pictures, lots of clips. It's so easy now to capture images and very easy to take a lot of them. But one of the things I've just really loved about listening to you talk about your work and your career is the way you describe being in the dark room and the magic of all of the chemical processes you had to do in the early days, before it became so easy, and that there was such a magic to the process of photography and getting the chemicals right and being in the dark room and watching the image come to life on the paper. I'm old enough to remember, Uncle, how that all worked. And it seems like in some ways listening to you talk about that, although you're absolutely right, we've got amazing cameras, the phones have great cameras, there was something about the art of photography back in that day where you had to go back into the dark room and bring the picture to life that sort of, when you talk about it, sounds really magical.
Magical. I was smitten by it from those early days in the dark room. And I inquired about dark room work, and over the years I designed and fitted out with a dark room at the TAFE in Sydney. Improve that and get to Dubbo, and we put in a dark room at the senior college here in Dubbo, and also a dark room at my old school, Dubbo High School. And people really like to get in there and paddle around, and might take a while to do it, but It's a process which you can work. Some people have, you know, don't have to have much training, but once you get into the mode of the process, it is fantastic. I mean, in the early days when we didn't have film, like the Daguerre and tin types and images on metal. Some people are still interested in that, and it's capturing those images in different forms. It's whatever it is. It's some of those images, you know, from the early days are still with us, and so that's fantastic.
Uncle Merv, you've photographed so many things, and as we've mentioned, there's been that range of the iconic big moments, those moments that stay with you, and then there's also those like intimate moments into somebody's life that we see. You've been on the other side of the camera for so long, and I wonder, maybe as a final reflection, what do you think your career and your artistry of capturing those moments has taught you about people and taught you about yourself?
Gee, I think that it'll never ever leave me. I look at images and I think that's nice. That's still have a look at magazines and books and the technology used to get those images. And I think people should really sort of look into libraries. You know, they might be thinking about it, but it takes a while, but some people are able to pick it up and go with it. And hats off to them. And I think that's the way of how I used to read about things and read about what other people were doing, and try to either not so much as copy. One of my favorite types of pictures is pictures of people, like in portraiture, to make images that the sitter is pleased with my image of them and what I, and so that they see themselves as somebody, and that goes and goes and goes over the years. I guess it's way different to artists with paint and other mediums. So photography is going to be around for a long time, and I'm so pleased that in my life that I was able to contribute as a person, as family, in that progression.
Well, if people want to see your work and hear more about your life, of course, now they can do that in this wonderful new book that you've got, Black, White and Colour. And, of course, can go and see those photographs that will be on display at the exhibition. It's called Mervyn Bishop Close Up at the State Library of New South Wales. So there's plenty of opportunity to engage both with your work and with your life story. So Uncle Mervyn Bishop, if I can just thank you so much for the way that you've helped us see the world differently through your art, your wonderful sense of being able to capture a moment and a person and a personality and make us feel connected to it, and for spending time with us on Speaking Out and sharing some of your wisdom and your stories. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Larissa.
Uncle Mervyn Bishop there. Uncle Merv is blazing a trail for those who will follow, chronicling Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australia in pictures. A new photographic exhibition titled Mervyn Bishop Close Up will be opening on the 20th of October at the State Library of New South Wales. The library acquired his archive last year and dug into it for a lot of personal photos, plus some classics from his working life. The Sydney book launch is sold out, but there are still tickets to see Mervyn and Tim Dobbin in conversation with Professor Brenda L. Croft at the Australian National University on the 24th of October at the Canberra Writers' Festival. That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Janaea Gibbs-Muir and Nadine Haynes. Our senior producer is Jay McAllister. And as always, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or on social media via ABC Indigenous, along with our Titter Show Away, hosted by the fabulous Rudy Bremer. This week, Rudy is joined by Candice LeRae to discuss Singing Our Futures, a program that's helping new and emerging First Nations singer-songwriters find their voice. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Speaking Out.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.